intergalactical upsets. Only Dr. Han Sarkov, formerly at NASA, has provided any explanation. This morning's unprecedented solar eclipse is no cause for alarm.
To bring back his body.
Gordon shall die.
Wake up to a brand new day.
I don't know what that is.
You could ask your wife. She liked that I posted that I was listening to it yesterday. By
sounds
NXS.
Like country. The way you're singing it sounded like a country song.
Maybe out of my mouth it does. It's NXS.
Which NXS song is that?
Original Sin.
Oh, okay. I know that song.
Must just be my rendition.
We saw NXS in concert. They played at the Air Force Academy before Michael Hutchins was murdered. Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, supposedly murdered. There's conspiracy theories.
Right. Yeah. Was that back when you were flying for Ferris Aircraft?
That's right.
Well, here comes the new co-host.
Oh.
Ready to podcast, Mabel?
How's she doing?
Pretty good.
Is she being a good girl?
Yeah, she had a fun day yesterday. We took her up to my parents for the first time, and man, she had a good time in their backyard.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, as they have a fenced-in backyard, we don't. So we took her up there and brought some of her toys with her, and my dad had a Frisbee that he found, and she was, I mean, in the house, she has a lot of energy, and she loves her toys, and loves playing fetch, but that gave her a chance to really run, you know?
Oh, yeah, cut loose.
And yeah, she was really cut loose, because sometimes she'd bring the toy back to you, then sometimes she'd just keep running past you and make a loop, and she was just booking it.
I bet she slept well, too.
Yeah. She's back at it this morning, though. After I took her out this morning, sitting there, and she brought her one ball over to me. Like, let's get going again.
Did you take her for a walk?
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah, we take her out a few times a day, although she's getting better, but she has a certain amount of skittishness, especially with loud noises and stuff.
Oh, yeah.
And we've already seen some improvement with it, but my theory that I won't be able to prove one way or the other is that we don't know how long, but she was astray for at least a certain amount of time.
Mm-hmm.
I think maybe that period of time of being astray on her own and stuff that she was probably frightened by a lot of the noises, you know?
Yeah.
Like traffic.
On guard.
Yeah, she was on a guard, so. But she's a good girl.
We're gonna be like Harley was exhausted after we took a trip to Denver last weekend.
And oh, right.
It was just to go see the Rockies game. They were playing the Mets. And we just decided to spend the night there. We left Harley, but they said they couldn't put her in the suite. Usually the suite is like a kind of like a closed in room with the window and a TV. And they couldn't get her in the suite, and they put her because they were doing maintenance on the suites. So she got like one of those smaller area things, and man, she came home and she was exhausted. Like she was always on guard or something, like the whole time she was there, even though it was only like 24 hours. She came home and she just didn't want to do nothing but sleep. And she was like restless too, like. She doesn't usually have issues like that, but I think with all the dogs near her and
yeah,
all the noise, whereas in the other room she has a TV, so it kind of masks some noise.
Yeah, so she probably didn't relax much.
Yeah. So did you have a, was the trip a long trip? I mean, is it a long drive?
No, I mean, I called it a mini road trip on Facebook, but it was just about a 45-minute drive one way.
Did she do good in the car?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, she was looking around for a while at first, and then she settled down, and she cracks me up because she's constantly doing the eyes trying to stay awake.
Yeah.
Whenever she's tired, she does it all the time where she's trying to hold her head up and her eyes are just down to slits. So she was doing that for a while in the car, and then she finally gave in and went to sleep.
Nice.
That cracks me up. She's always trying to stay awake. Doesn't want to miss anything. But yeah, we weren't sure. You know, we've only taken her to Kara's parents, and because they're closer, and we weren't sure how she would adjust because she was meeting new people. And but I think especially because she was able to be off the leash and had the space to run around, she adjusted real good, and we stayed even longer than we thought we were going to be able to.
Yeah.
She was doing good, yeah. So she had a good time. But yeah, she kept stopping behind my dad was cooking chicken on the grill.
To run around and go by the grill.
Yeah, so she would every once in a while she'd be running. We'd be playing fetch with her, and then instead of coming back, she'd stop behind my dad and just plop down on the ground and stare at him like, "Hey, look at me, I'm a good girl. Want any help with that chicken there?"
Nice.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes me laugh too. She knows to sit if she's getting something. You know, she already seemed to know that when we got her, and so she'll. That's one way that I know she's interested in, like my lunch or something like that. So I'll be making it, and she'll all of a sudden I'll turn around, she's sitting nice and pretty. Like here I am. I'm good. I'm a good girl. I'll have some of that. I'll have that sandwich.
Is she good when you're away from the house?
Yeah, we've been, we've been crating her.
Yeah, crate training her.
Yeah, well, she had some familiarity with it. And she, when she came up from Ohio with her puppies, they came up in a crate, and they were using a crate at her foster home. So she whines when we're leaving her, but then I think she relaxes.
Yeah.
Usually when we come home, she's just chilling in there. But the cat, he's ever the usurper. You know, we've tried to get him his own little beds and stuff like that, and he has no interest in it. But he did the same thing with Luna. He always wants to use the dog's beds. And the other day we came in the bedroom and we found him in the dog crate just sitting there relaxing.
Yeah. And
it's hilarious looking because it's tiny. You could fit like 10 more of them in there probably with him. He's so small compared to the crate. So I think he's like, well, I'll try this out too. But they've been getting along a lot better, the two of them.
Yeah.
She still tries to play with him and chase him around.
And he doesn't not
interested. No. But
he's a lot older, though, too.
Yeah, he's like We're not exactly sure, but I think he's like 12.
Yeah.
So that's part of it too, but when she's in her more docile mood or when she's tired, they'll sometimes be pretty close to each other and just leave each other alone.
Yeah.
And a lot of times when we do leave her, we'll come home and he'll be chilling in the same room, probably because he knows she can't get at him. So yeah, they've improved a lot since the first couple days.
Good. Glad things are going well. Well, let's kick this bad boy off. So, I thought we could start with some questions.
Okay, yeah, I glanced at Facebook, so it seems like there was some good ones in there.
Yeah, Stephanie Tibbler Green said, this is from her 8-year-old daughter. She wants to know if Batman's utility belt is like Mary Poppins' purse. Have you seen Mary Poppins?
I have, and I should phone a
Recently?
no, no, but I've seen it
I
more than
don't.
once.
I've seen it once, maybe, but I was like 7. I don't remember it. I
Yeah, I
remember
think.
it being like a musical, and I remember it had Dick Van Dyke.
Yeah, and Julie Andrews as
Julie
Mary
Andrews, yeah.
Poppins, yeah.
Sound of Music. So I imagine her purse is magical, like she can reach into her purse and pull some stuff out.
Yeah, that's, I believe, what it's like.
Well, if that's true, then it's totally different than Batman's utility belt because it's basically stocked to whatever he puts in there,
Right.
where she can reach in her bag and then pull anything out.
It's an interesting question because it kind of goes beyond probably her daughter's interest. Because essentially, his utility belt is kind of like her purse, but not in the world of the story. Like it's not supposed to have whatever he needs, but it usually does.
I think of it as a carpenter's belt. He has a bunch of various tools that he needs to do the job. Or he thinks he needs to do the job.
I gotta team up with my sister on this question because I know about Batman. She knows about Mary Poppins.
Yeah.
I'm texting her. I don't know if she'll answer me in
Phone a
time.
friend.
Yeah, but oh, yeah, it looks like she's writing right back here. So we'll see. Gotta
All
pull
the
in the expert.
resources.
Yeah, she loves Mary Poppins. She has the movie. She's seen it a whole bunch of times, and I think she went to the musical, and it's one of her favorite movies. I bought her. I don't think she was even aware of like the Funko Pop vinyls.
Yeah.
And I found out they had a Mary Poppins one, so I bought it for her. She said, "Yes, I think so. Why do you have one? I have a Mary Poppins purse."
Can you pull out magic things out of it?
Yeah, I have to ask her. I'm gonna, 'cause that could be useful. I'm not aware. Maybe I can make use of it.
It's a magic bag. At least I googled it. So she's more like into the supernatural. She's
I
got like
guess, yeah.
another dimension in her bag.
Right.
I wish I'd have a bag like that for storing comics. Like it's just, if you could fit all my comic collection into that magic bag, man, Barb would be so happy.
Yeah.
So she'd be like, put your comics away now. And I'd just reach in there and put them away. And then when I wanted to read them, I'd reach in there and pull it out.
It could just be one long box, the magic long box.
Yeah.
And you think about what comics you want to read, and then you just lift the top, and those are the ones that are in there.
That'd be sweet. Instant gratification.
I asked my sister if she can pull anything out of her Mary Poppins purse that she wants, and she said, pretty much, yes. LOL.
All
So
right.
she's probably like Batman in that she's always prepared for what she might need.
Yeah, it's more like Batman. It's not magical.
Right.
I would hate to carry a purse. It just seems like most purses are so much weight.
Yeah.
And you're always like, it's one thing to have a wallet, which makes you lopsided when you sit down and shit.
Yeah.
But it's still compact, you know?
Right.
Purses is like carrying a backpack all the time, it seems like.
Yeah, I wouldn't really want to. I don't really need. I just usually have my phone on. And you know, actually, I stopped using a wallet when my grandfather passed away. One of the things I picked out from his personal effects was he had a money clip. So I started using a money clip when I got that, and I've been using it now for quite a few years. So I just have my, I hardly ever have cash on me anyways, but it's technically a credit card clip or something. But I just use that in my front pocket, and so I'm never sitting on it, and it's pretty thin. And I like the fact that I always have something that belonged to him with me,
What's funny?
Never, I'm laughing because I never thought I'd be talking about my choice of money clip
Money
on
clips.
a podcast. It's funny the things that come up.
Donnie Salvo says, out of your collection, what title do you have the most comics? I think, like, what title you have the most of?
Right. Yeah, I can answer that one thanks to my statistics here. But I gotta bring it back up. Yeah, I'm interested to hear your answer on this. This is a
I don't know offhand.
question. Can you find that out from your database or no?
I could find out statistics, but it's by a publisher. I'd have to like write some special query to find out.
Oh, okay. So I use I think it goes by CBZ or collectors with a Z.com, comic collector. I use Comic Collector. You can look at a bunch of different statistics. But I kind of knew off the top of my head already. I didn't have to look at it to see that the Flash Volume 2 is my most by a significant margin, because I have the whole run of that, 250 issues or so. And that's I knew that that's the longest run I have of something. But I was kind of curious what would come after that, and it's actually at this point, because I've been ever since I completed that, I've been picking up issues of Volume 1. So it's actually Volume 1 that's second on my list after that.
I would say
But
it was the same for me too, though. If I had to guess, but I would say probably if it's title, it'd be like Justice League because there's so many volumes of it and it's always been published. And I have every incarnation of it.
Yeah.
So if you throw in all the Justice League Europe's, Justice League, Justice League of America, Justice League International, Justice League Task Force, Justice League Europe,
Yeah.
Justice League Quarterly. I would say
Right.
Justice League is probably everything. I mean, I have every Justice League since 73, and I have quite a bit of pre that. So, yeah.
I wonder what your longest would be if you were just talking about each volume separately.
Well, it's easy, probably it's probably Action Comics
Yeah.
because it goes my Action Comics collection goes far, 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 far back, and it's always been published.
Right.
And yeah, it's probably Action Comics.
Yeah,
You would
I
think
would
it'd
have
be
guessed.
Detective, but it's not. I have more
But yeah.
Superman than I do Batman, believe it or not. But not,
Oh.
no, that's not true. I have more Superman slash Action Comics than I have Batman slash Detective Comics.
Not
and I
just
guess on the Marvel
the
side, it
characters,
would
different
be
titles.
on the Marvel side, it would probably be Daredevil as a whole with all the volumes, and it'd probably be as a whole as a longest running, which is volume one, because it goes like to three something, and I have almost every issue, so that's quite a bit.
Which one? What is it?
Daredevil Volume 1.
Oh, Volume 1, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would have said with it was probably going to be either Action or Detective because you kind of have to, knowing your collection, it kind of ends up being what title ran the longest.
And I guess independent, it'd probably be Savage Dragon or slash Spawn, except Spawn, I don't have a continuous run. Spawn has more issues. But I have every Savage Dragon, so don't know. Interesting. So that was from Donnie Salvo. Ken Jr. says, "What writer or artist of old is deserving of more praise?" That's easily. That's Jack Kirby. Just.
Because there can never be enough.
There can never be enough, and he's done so much, but there's still other people that shadow him, and that shouldn't be that overshadow him, and that shouldn't be true. He was a workhorse, man. You know, he did so much. Nobody could do his output
No.
ever. Somebody could try and then they'd pass out. They wouldn't make it. And they didn't have all the cheats back then.
Right.
They had to draw everything. They didn't have like computer tools where they could Photoshop a building in and draw over it, you know?
Yeah. I guess the first name that comes to my mind, and I wouldn't have said this until recently, having as a result of research I did on my From Kid to Flash, was John Broome. I
Yeah,
don't think his name is talked about a lot in the way that some other creators from that era are, but when I looked at the list of characters that he created, particularly during his run on Green Lantern, but also the characters that he created on The Flash,
yeah.
he's so important to the DC Silver Age, and there's so many characters that he co-created that are still in use today. And when I ran that down and just learned what I could about his career, I was really impressed.
Yeah. He's definitely done a lot, that's for sure. And
Yeah.
a lot of people, though, do recognize him, but usually have to go to like DC centric podcasts.
Yeah,
There's
it's definitely
so many
known.
podcasts, it's incredible, you know?
Yeah.
Like sometimes I listen to the Fire and Water podcast. That's like my go-to when I run out of. Because I only listen to like three or four, but
Right.
sometimes I run out when like Comics and History is not really coming out right now, so I'll go to Fire and Water and I like listen to the in the middle before listener feedback. It's like they have all these, you could listen to this or that, and I'm like, damn.
Yeah, they do the spin-off where they go through the Who's Who
Yeah.
issues, which is that's my favorite, and
My
Shag
favorite
is
is the Aquaman stuff, and I dig Firestorm, but I like just the regular issues the most.
Gotcha.
And then when he has like when they did like Blue Devil and they had some specials on some of the more obscure characters, I really dig those.
Yeah, those are good.
Yeah.
The Plastic Man was really good. The Plastic Man
Yeah.
one they did. But yeah, Shag makes a point of naming different blogs or podcasts that relate to the characters that they talk about on Who's
Yeah,
Who.
they go to the extreme. I mean, it's one thing to shout out like our people that ask questions, but they shout out every tweet that does
Yeah.
pound fire and water podcast.
Yeah, I mean they've built a good community
Yeah,
around the show, so I guess that's part of it, which is definitely cool.
So yeah, Jack Kirby as a writer and artist is my answer. Just because he did so much, but then I could dig into a bunch of other like DC
Yeah.
writers and stuff that I really enjoy in the Silver Age and the Golden Age and Bronze Age.
Yeah.
Like Chuck Dixon's prolific, I think. He's done a lot for the comics, especially in the Batman universe and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Keith Giffen, he's done a lot. I mean, if you go back in his career, he's done an awful lot of stuff. I really love his stuff too. I didn't used to, and I've totally become a Keith Giffen fan. A matter of fact, for the Valiant podcast, I think, or one of the side things I'm going to do is Punks, which he did for Valiant. I'm curious about it. To read it again. It was a satire book.
Do you think those guys are underrated though, or
Keith Giffen?
Do they deserve more praise?
I think he's underrated.
Yeah.
Yeah. You don't hear a lot of people talk about Keith Giffen. I mean, unless they're talking like Legion or, you know, I don't hear too much about Ambush Bug or any of the other stuff he's done. But I don't listen to a lot, so I don't know.
Yeah. Well, but
in general, it's like, he's not like a big name like McFarlane or, I mean, you say those names and people know them, you know.
True.
And he's done so much more. He just was so influential during a time that people could communicate more about comics, it seems like. So time period, I think, has a lot to do with it, too.
Yeah, I could see that where it's, it might not be that someone's, that people are unaware of him as a creator, but they're not, they might not be aware of how much they actually contributed.
Yeah. Current would be Matt Kent. I love Matt Kent. But as a writer, I Brian Wood, man, he can write words on a toilet paper and I'd read it. I really like what he writes. like Starve. I never thought I'd like love a book that's about like post-apocalyptic cooking. I mean,
yeah, I just ordered the first three issues of that because
so good.
I'm looking forward to reading them, and I got Rebels.
Yeah, I saw you got Rebels.
Yeah, those came out.
I really like his stuff. Even when he was doing Star Wars, it was really good. And then DMZ, and I don't know. He read the only one that I haven't read that I should get into at some point is Northlanders.
Yeah, I would like to read that too.
Yeah.
He did a bunch of his stuff that I, before I really knew about him as a creator, that I want to check out at some point.
I really like his stuff. I even think he interviews well. I've heard a couple interviews with him. I know he's got a bad reputation for something he did in San Diego many years ago with a woman.
Right. Yeah.
But I don't like to get – I don't like to even hear about like – I don't like interviews in general. I don't know why. I don't listen to interview shows. I don't want to know about things about the creators that I like. I don't know why that is. I mean, I'll listen to them sometimes. Like, I listened to the Brian Wood one on Comics Therapy. This happened when I started running out of podcasts. And I thought he, I he, what he has to say, like, I don't think I agree with him on stuff, but what he says is not crazy, even in politics and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But I don't agree with him, but he's not like Donald Trump crazy. And he always has like reasons for what he does. So that I like that. I could respect that. But I don't know about that other shenanigans thing, other than it really blew up about 2 years ago, I think, on the interwebs.
Yeah, I remember that, and I don't get real deep into. I'm definitely not interested in a lot of that stuff. I mean, if someone is a heinous individual and a creator is like a really, I don't know, a bad person, however you want to define that, which is really ambiguous. But I guess what I'm trying to say is there are things that might lead me to not want to support somebody, you know, not want to put money in their pockets. My takeaway from that whole situation, and I could be wrong, and because I'm obviously, like a lot of people, not part of the situation, but my takeaway from that situation is that it was something, like mistakes were made, and there was regret. And I do believe in forgiveness, and if, you know, people, and I do believe that people make mistakes and can change, you know?
Yeah.
But I mean, if there was a pattern of repeat behavior and people are coming out of the woodwork to say things, but you know, sometimes people do things they're not proud of. And sometimes the internet can be really bad and how it gangs up on people, and people are, it's almost as if they're just waiting to trash on somebody.
Yeah.
So,
and then it's hard to believe what, because you have like a couple of perspectives, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I believe that he did do something bad, just based on the person that came out.
Yeah. Yeah, I wouldn't condone. It's not a matter of condoning something, you know?
Yeah. I think he's talented, though, because he comes up with a lot of ideas and stuff in comic books that I enjoy. And the way he puts the word on the page, my brain doesn't have to think. It's very fluid. Certain writers, I don't. It just reads really fluid. And for him, he reads really fluid. So, yeah. But he says of old. So, I think Michael Friedman, I think that's his name. I like all of his stuff that he did with, like, Spectre and stuff. I think he...
Well, that's a good one.
I think he did a lot of stuff. Like, if you read Back Issue Magazine, his name comes up a lot. And then you, like, realize, wow, this guy did a lot of shit. Jerry Conway, another writer that I liked for Spider-Man and Firestorm, like, an awful lot. He did a lot of Justice League stuff. Len Wein, you know, like, for Blue Beetle and New Gods. He did so much stuff. Wolverine, he created Wolverine. He didn't bring Wolverine into the prominence that we know, but he wrote Hulk 181, so there's a lot of good writers, I mean, and artists. So, Jim Dietz says, what's your favorite goofy Silver Age hero or villain?
What's the what? Sorry.
What's your favorite goofy Silver Age hero or villain?
Do you have one? I gotta think about it. I didn't see this one.
I'm gonna interpret goofy. It's just really weird. But I would say Inferior Five from DC Comics in the Silver Age. Those were like ridiculous characters that was highly entertaining. And for some reason, Brother Power the Geek has always fascinated me ever since I bought his two-issue miniseries at a hotel con when I was younger in college. I was like, this is the weirdest shit I've ever seen.
Oh, yeah. You do mention him a lot.
I do. Yeah, he's bizarre. And, yeah, I think those are goofy. Like, even the Creeper's weird, but I don't think he's considered goofy. But Brother Power the Geek was definitely goofy, and they canceled it for because the one editor didn't like hippies. Thought they were lazy. But in Fear 5, they're entertaining. Angel and the Ape, that's an entertaining Silver Age series. I'd like to complete at some point. Matter of fact, I'm going to a hotel con later to just do some shopping.
Today?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I want to stay focused on Batman because, man, I have so much holes in Batman for my goal. But I also want to complete my Titans run because I have every incarnation of Teen Titans, Team Titans, Titans, mm-hmm. New Teen Titans, everything except for the first run. I'm missing like 10 books. So even though some of those are pre-1973, I'd sure like to complete that run. The other run that's pre-1973 I'd like to complete is Hawkman. I love Hawkman. There's just something about Thanagar and the history and such the weird backstory. Like my favorite comics in history episodes and ones that I'll listen to again and again are the Hawkman ones. Because I just love the character and I like the way he does it.
Yeah, like, he did a good job on those.
One thing I like what he does is he gives you like a lot of history on it, and it's not really panel by panel, but I like the way he does stuff. He does stuff slightly different. He gives you a lot of the history and the time period, and then he tells you how he what the book is about at a high level. And then he tells you how he feels about the book. Mm-hmm. And I kind of like that. So yeah, I like Hawkman a lot. I have a Hawkman companion. I'd like to get into the Golden Age Hawkman too. DC's putting out some great collected editions. They're collecting a lot of 80s stuff now, like Suicide Squad, Deathstroke the Terminator.
Yeah, they're doing the Nightwing and Robin.
Nightwing solo and Robin. And I ordered the Nightwings and I ordered the Robin. I didn't order the Deathstroke. I ordered the Suicide Squad just because I would love to have those, the Suicide Squad on hardcover, though. Like the next one that I have like is Infinity Inc. and Secret Society of Supervillains. I'd love to have the Suicide Squad in that form. Do you have Suicide Squad New 52?
No, I think I tried a couple issues in the beginning. And
did you try early, like number one?
Yeah, yeah.
And do you have it? Sell it now. No, you don't care. Have it. Oh, you don't
I
have
think
it?
I don't think I even had...
it's going for $80 to $100.
Jeez.
Just because of Harlequin.
Yeah. No, I think I had a second print.
Like I told Keith last night, you have no attachment to the New 52. You should sell that fucker right now.
Mm-hmm.
Because you bought it for like $1.99 or something from DCBS, and
right.
you're going to make at least 50, 60 bucks on it.
Yeah, it was only like 4 years ago.
And that's one that if you turned it now and sold it at a good price, like even if you got 30, that's astronomical. You know what I mean?
Right.
Because as soon as that movie passes, if you could just wait 5 to 10 years, you're going to get it cheap again. Like it's going to be worth nothing. Whereas like if you were to tell me that Batman Adventures, first appearance of Harley Quinn, I'd say, well, that's a good investment because it'll never go down.
Yeah.
It's the first appearance of Harley Quinn. It's not the first costume in the New 52 era.
Right.
Yeah.
And it's not, Suicide Squad number one is not worth a lot because of a low print run either.
No.
You know, because that can be a factor sometimes with value.
Yeah, like I'm trying to find, I have one damn Milestone comic to finish, and it's Icon 42. It's the last issue. Mm-hmm. And I can't find that fucker because it's such a low print run. You know, it's the last issue. It's a low print run. The people that want to sell it are selling it for $50. And I'm like,
yeah.
God dang, I could spend $120 and get the whole release over again. It doesn't seem logical to spend $50 on one issue. You know what I mean? It just right. seems so wrong. I would spend another $100 just to get the whole issue and have dupes.
Yeah.
Because I feel like I'd have more for my value, for the value than 50 on one. It just makes no sense.
Yeah. Yeah, the back issue that's really irritating me for its value right now is Birds of Prey number 8.
Oh, yeah, the Nightwing issue.
Yeah.
I broke down and just bought it. I paid a lot, but I didn't pay a lot because it keeps going up.
Yeah.
So, I mean, when you consider books that'll always be, I don't know, sort of popular.
I thought about it at times also based on the fact that I've gotten most of the run of Birds of Prey for 50 cents an issue.
Yeah.
So that's even cheaper than if I bought it at the time.
Yeah, it just depends on how you want it and
you
really need to complete it. Because you could read it digitally, you know?
Right.
Really. Yeah. We're in it for a story. It just, do you want, is your collector mentality going to take over?
Right.
Because I'm first a comic book reader. At least that's what I consider myself.
Second, yeah, me too, I'm a definitely. Collector. Right.
It's the second priority.
Yeah.
I love completing runs, though. I, like, love it. It's, like, fun.
Yeah, so I don't know. I out of curiosity, I have a Google search saved. And, you know, supposedly number 8, it was a low print run. But you wouldn't know that from how frequently it's being posted and sold on eBay.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think people are trying to get more for it than they're actually getting.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but whatever.
So did you have any goofy characters? Are there any Bob Haney characters that you've run across that are zany?
I haven't run across too many that he created that are zany. He has a tendency to take characters that are already created and put them in zany situations.
Yeah.
But,
well, he didn't really say crazy. It just, is there, oh yeah, I see what you're saying. He didn't really write any characters that were goofy. He made them goofy.
Yeah, like the characters themselves weren't inherently goofy. His plots and stories were. I've always thought the concept of Our Man, which that would actually be a Golden Age character, but I've always thought that concept of Our Man was pretty goofy. You know, that he takes a pill and it's only good for an hour. And
I like that. I thought that was
because
it made you so vulnerable. That's what I like about it.
Yeah, I mean, I say it in a loving way. You know,
yeah.
I like the character, and I like what they did with the character later. But I just think it's a funny concept. It's not a bad concept. It works because, like you said, it builds you a vulnerability right in there, and then you can always use that plot device as to create tension. You know, having the power wear off.
Yeah. Golden Age, though, you have a couple of them. You got Ma Huckle. She's kind of goofy, and she was always comic relief.
Yeah,
definitely. And she had those crazy kids, and she wore a pot on her head.
Mm-hmm.
So she was goofy as hell. And I always thought Johnny Thunder was too, because
yeah,
he had that power of that spirit, which could grant his, you know, the Thunderbolt could grant his wishes and stuff and make him really powerful. But as a person, he was really weird. Mm-hmm. He was goofy.
Oh yeah, he was kind of like the Jar Jar Binks of DC's Golden Age.
Yeah, the Justice Society.
Because he was always doing things in the way that Jar Jar did, where it was always accidental.
Yeah.
At least that's my impression. I've looked at a few stories, but
yeah, if you especially like the All-Star Squadron stuff.
Right.
He wasn't even invited. He just accidentally invited himself.
Yeah.
And it's like Ma Huckle invited herself. Like, why didn't I get an invite?
Yeah.
And she tore her drawers. As she came in through the window.
Yeah, I like how I like the idea of just these random wannabe heroes showing up randomly at the JSA brownstone. Just
yeah. I think Ambush Bug is a goofy character.
Meant to be.
He's like Deadpool before Deadpool was Deadpool.
Yeah, I'll take Ambush Bug any day over
Deadpool. Me too. I hated Ambush Bug though when he first came out. Mm. Hated him because I didn't understand the humor of it. And now I think he's hilarious. Like that Convergence Ambush Bug Supergirl, mm-hmm. I thought it was phenomenal. Like I laughed my ass off reading that.
All right, I know I read the first one. I can't remember if I read the second issue yet. I still have a bunch of number twos to read.
So funny. That was Giffen. That was good stuff. All right, so those were all the questions on my wall, and then I think we had one or two on the Geek Brunch podcast wall. So,
okay, yeah, because there was something about...
Yeah, David Levine said, how many comics to a bag, one piece of tape or two, and horizontal or vertical? I can answer that really quick. One comic per bag. The only time I ever do two to a bag is if I have like so many dupes and they were like free dupes. If it's a book that has any value, I will give it a separate bag. And then I use one piece of tape across the middle because I find that the two pieces of tape are harder to get a book in and out quickly without error. Mm-hmm. The horizontal or vertical on the, I assume he's talking about the tape. I do the tape horizontal, right across the middle.
Yeah.
And I don't like the two tapes because I've accidentally got books caught on the tape before because of that. So I do the one tape, and I've never had an incident ever since.
Mm-hmm. Definitely only one comic per bag. I can see why sellers will sometimes ship them two to a bag.
Yeah.
But as far as, yeah, storing them or whatever, just one per bag. Because I like to flip through and I don't want to have to look at the back to see the cover.
Yeah.
And I don't tape anymore. I buy the sealing bags, self-sealing bags. Yeah. Once I found out about those, I really like those. The way that they close. You still kind of have to open them slow because if you go too quick, sometimes they will tear a little bit.
Yeah.
But not all my comics are in those, but I've put a lot of them in those.
Mm-hmm.
But when I did tape, I did what you do. I did one piece of tape horizontally in the middle.
Yeah.
Cause yeah, I don't want to have to deal with two pieces of tape if I want to open it back up. And I feel like, and I always found that the horizontal tape worked better than the vertical. Cause something about how much of the, how much of the length of it was on the seam helped it from tearing the tape or the bag.
The worst tape is to get that Scotch tape, the Scotch one that is, I can't remember if it's the transparent or whatever, but if you open it once, it tears the tape in half. I like the generic brand where the tape is a little more thick, and when you take it across, you could retape with the same piece of tape. So
yeah, it's actually better. The type of tape you'd want for other projects is not the tape that you want for your comics.
Exactly.
You want tape that isn't as sticky.
Yeah.
As you'd want for other purposes. Yeah, I used to hate that. You peel up a little bit of the tape to open it, and then it tears right along the seam of the flap.
Yeah.
But.
And our last question is from Joe Crawford. He says it's a repost. What comic book deaths have affected you the most?
Good question.
Sue Dibney, man. I cried for days. It was devastating. And I also cried again when Robin got his father killed, because I was so attached to that Chuck Dixon run and his father.
Mm.
And when Boomerang threw the boomerang through his chest, I find it devastating. Those are the two that I think of offhand that really bothered me.
Yeah, I can think of more characters coming back to life that bother me.
Blue Beetle bothered me because it didn't seem like there was a legitimate reason
Ted
for
Cord,
his death.
Yeah.
It really felt weird to me because the story wasn't bad. It was a good, solid story. It just felt weird because you had Maxwell Lord just turn ape shit, and nobody would believe him. Nobody would believe Ted. You know?
Yeah, that always felt to me like, well, we got a plan for a new Blue Beetle, so who's a character that's high profile enough that it'll be shocking, but not so high profile that we're planning to do anything with him?
Yeah.
But I didn't like the way that DC handled the Flashes around Infinite Crisis.
Yeah.
Going to the same era. And that's what I sort of was alluding to, is that I was okay, even though he was my favorite character, I was okay with the idea of Wally dying, because it echoed the sacrifice that Barry made. And you had this event that was kind of the sequel, in a lot of ways, it was being billed to Crisis on Infinite Earths, you know. And so Wally making a similar sacrifice, a Flash dying in the Crisis event. And at that point, he'd been the Flash for 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
So I actually liked the idea and the sort of symmetry of it, to have Bart take up the mantle, you know. And I think that's what they really were going to do. And then they backpedaled on all of it because of the reaction to the Bart Flash series and the negative reviews. And I think that it was irritating to me that they backpedaled all of that. And then you had Barry come back and, so yeah, I mean, it would have been interesting to see them stick to their guns there and have Bart really take on the mantle. Cause he had done a lot of change in growing up, you know?
Yeah.
As Kid Flash for a while there, going from Impulse to Kid Flash, and it would have been interesting to see, but I guess it would have been a few years down the road all wiped out by the new 52 anyways. But yeah, I wasn't crazy about how the Flash was handled for a while there.
Mm-hmm. Jason Todd was a weird one too.
Mm-hmm.
Because that was a vote. But I wasn't impacted because of the nature of it.
Yeah.
So,
I kind of had that with Damian a bit, because I actually stopped reading DC for a while.
Yeah.
Because it just sort of got on my nerves that there was so much publicity to a child being killed, and I think it was the timing with other like stuff in the news and stuff. I just wasn't into it, and I needed a break. And I knew he wasn't even going to be dead for that long, you know.
I actually don't think the death was that. It didn't, like, it wasn't a punch to me, though, like, the death itself. It was the aftermath of the death that was more heartfelt, I think.
Yeah, I was just going to say that there was some good writing when I went back and caught up, and I read some of the Batman and Robin series that followed when it was always Batman and someone else. There was some good comic books and some good writing that came out of it. And I'm not necessarily criticizing it now in hindsight, but at the time it wasn't the right time for me to read something like that, I guess.
Yeah.
Or to have a Robin killed again. And, I was more interested in them just continuing to develop Damian's character and they've picked that back up again. And, you know, but, it just seemed like so much to do to Batman. It's like, all right, here's a guy who already lost his parents and they were going to put him through losing his child as well. I didn't feel like reading that.
Yeah. The one that shocked me was Kyle's girlfriend, the fridge scene. I was shit. Because they introduced him, when they introduced him, like his girlfriend was like really close to him.
Yeah.
And they had built her up just to kill her. And that was pretty shocking. I guess the Gwen Stacy one from the Marvel is pretty shocking too. Just the fact that he saved her and her neck snaps. You know.
Yeah, historically. I wonder what it would have been like to read that at the time. I mean, I think before
and
I ever
was
read that
dead,
issue.
And that's when dead meant dead.
Yeah.
Easily.
Yeah. Yeah, because I think before I ever read that issue, I already knew what happened, so I wonder what it would have been like to read it and not know.
Yeah. All right. You could probably do a whole podcast just talking about stuff like that.
Yeah, comic book deaths.
So let's jump into our movie.
Sure. Dragon Slayer.
Yeah, I don't know how you're gonna feel about this, but I think I love it so much just because of what it was and when I saw it. But I absolutely love it. Like I think the special effects still hold up today. I think the storyline is awesome. Yeah, it's a little slow and it's not like a total action adventure, but the plot is really solid.
Mm-hmm.
And I really dug it. But the story in general, I'll just briefly describe just the plot.
Sure.
It's about an apprentice, a sorcerer apprentice. The story focuses around him when a group of men go to the sorcerer to try to help them get rid of a dragon. And the sorcerer is like really old. He looks like he's in his 80s, maybe 90s, and he's a legitimate sorcerer, and he has an apprentice, and he has like a tower guard who's like even older than him. He's like almost 100, yeah. He looks like. And his name is Hodge. And Galen is the the apprentice, and they come and they say, yeah, we'll help you out. But the king sends a knight and two other guys over because they do not want to stop this lottery. They're able to keep the dragon tame by giving a virgin to the dragon, I guess, quarterly, or I don't remember if they said the frequency, but they have to do this lottery and sacrifice a virgin to the dragon, and the dragon won't burn their crops or burn their houses or attack the castle or anything. It basically tames the dragon. And I guess the king is cautious, and he knows that they're doing this, so he sends this one knight, and he doesn't believe anything, and he wants proof that there's magic. And there's a trick where he grabs a dagger and he says, put this jewel in the box, and the apprentice never puts the jewel in the box. But he drives the dagger, he says, drive the dagger through my chest, through my heart. And when he does that, it kills him. At least we think it does, which is part of the story. And it turns into a whole journey with the apprentice going to help. And the apprentice seems pretty powerful because he uses that jewel to do things of magic. And the other key part of the plot point, which I thought was amazing, was that one of the guys that comes over is the daughter of another. It's a girl that's pretending to be a boy so she doesn't have to go to the lottery. And they essentially fall in love. And there were titties. It was a PG movie that had breasts. There was naked butt in there, too.
Like side.
Yeah.
Side boob.
Yeah, side boob.
Yeah,
so when I saw
back
that.
In the good old days.
Yeah. Like side boob, there's naked. Because he discovers her when he's in a lake. She's swimming or bathing. And he dives in the water and goes underwater. And he like starts choking on the water because it reveals that she's a woman.
Yeah.
And he pretends to know it all the time that she was a woman. But they fall in love. And he goes after the dragon, essentially. And what's cool about it is he takes out the dragon early on, at least you think. He drops the whole fucking mountain on him.
Yeah.
But
causes an avalanche.
Yeah, he doesn't have much control when he does stuff. And I like the way it ends, too, because it almost makes it look like that jewel and the ashes were a manifestation. It was really the sorcerer that was the source of power, and once he lost the jewel, he really had none. He had no magic.
Yeah. Yeah, it seemed concentrated on the jewel.
Yeah. But what did you think?
I liked it. I agree that the plot was good, because there was a number of times where it seemed like it was at the end of the movie. I mean, I could see what the playtime was currently, and I knew how long the movie was, so I knew it wasn't over. There was a number of times where it seemed like the movie was over, and then something would happen to keep it going. Like you said, he seems to have killed the dragon, and that had an interesting effect on everyone else, because Valerian, the girl that was pretending to be a boy, she figures at that point, well, the dragon's dead, I don't have to be worried about being chosen in the lottery. And so she comes out at the party with girls with girl clothes on, with a dress on, for the first time, and everyone's like, what the hell? And Galen,
I'm surprised the more people weren't mad, though.
Yeah, you got a little bit of that, I remember there was one guy that said something like, "Well, I wish I'd been as clever as you are," to her father.
Because my daughter would be alive too. That's what he said. Yeah.
Yeah, but there's also an interesting character of the king's daughter. The king has been keeping his own daughter out of it, and she's not aware of that at first. She thinks that she's just been not chosen, and then she finds out that her father and maybe some other rich men have been keeping their daughters out of the lottery. So she actually, when they realize that the dragon is still alive, she actually fixes the lottery herself so that she'll be chosen.
That's pretty cool, though, because the king shits his pants and he starts pulling out different names, mm-hmm. and they're all the daughter's name. And it's kind of ballsy because the daughter really believes she was part of it, you know?
Yeah.
She felt like horribly bad when she found out that not only her, but everybody that had wealth was kept out of the lottery.
Right.
They were naive to it. And she said, fuck this. I'm going to make a sacrifice. She believed in the cause.
Right.
What she didn't believe in is that the rich should be kept out of it and the poor would have to just suffer.
Yeah. Yeah, so she has the real leadership qualities that are admirable compared to her father, the real king.
Oh, he was an asshole. Yeah. He was an asshole.
Yeah, I did like it because there's a self-awareness about it that's really interesting. As a fantasy setting, there's humorous moments, but it's not a satire. You know, it's a serious movie, but there's, like you described the scene in the beginning, there's all this setup that the wizard is very powerful. And for that test, and he's even encouraging the knight to stab him with the dagger.
Yeah.
Like, don't worry, you can't hurt me. And then, yep, he pretty much dies.
Well, you know what's cool about that? Because when you see it for the first time, you really think he's dead.
Mm-hmm.
And you think he's dead, at least when I saw it, I thought he was dead because he failed to do what the sorcerer told him. He says, go get the dagger, bring the dagger down, put the jewel in that little chest.
Mm-hmm.
He put it on the table and didn't put it into the chest until later.
Mm-hmm.
And I always thought when he was a kid, I was like, oh, he fucked up, so the sorcerer's dead.
Mm-hmm.
So he really, it's his fault. But it's almost like the sorcerer knew ahead of time what he would do and what he wouldn't do, you know, by looking in that pool of water. He already knew what was going on.
Yeah. Yeah, so I like the way that scene played out is kind of to surprise you. And the way that things keep sort of turning on their head, the way I was talking about with it, presenting you with different moments that seem like it could be the ending of the story. So, you know, how it seems like everything is good. He killed the dragon. And so Valerian reveals herself as being a girl. But then as a result, they find out the dragon's not dead. So then he gets thrown in jail. And then, yeah, the whole thing, like, it just kept introducing more elements that I thought were interesting. Then you have the element of the princess and what she does, and he almost becomes more of a, like, in the final battle, he isn't really able to use his wizard sorcerer's powers, and so he becomes more of like a knight, you know, with the weapon. So there's a weapon that the Valerian's father is a blacksmith, so he helps put together a weapon.
That's awesome too. It's a huge spear. It really was designed to be a dragon slayer.
Yeah.
And the other thing that's cool is Valerian makes the shield of scales, which is awesome, mm-hmm. and it saves his life like 3 times.
Yeah. Yeah, those were some cool effects with the fire breathing.
Yeah.
And hiding behind the shield. But even, like, with...
even the princess dies, though, because she believes in the cause so much, she goes into the cave.
Right.
Like, he frees her. There's a scene where the king says, please save my daughter. You could have your jewel back. I need you to save my daughter. But that one knight of his goes after to stop him, and because he doesn't believe – I don't think he respects the king, really. I think he believes in the cause, you know, like the dragon will leave us alone if we keep sacrificing virgins. And he doesn't want Galen to stop that. And he doesn't care if the princess is going to die either. So the princess actually runs in the cave, and you find out that there's babies and there's baby dragons.
Yeah.
And Galen ends up killing the knight because he pierces like the post where they sacrifice the virgins. And the spear goes through the post and into the knight, even though he was protected by the post. And then he goes in there and he finds out the princess is dead, that the little baby dragons have killed her, and he kills each dragon. And then he goes deeper into the cave to try to fight the dragon. And he doesn't remember that Hodge told him, you must throw the master's ashes into the burning lake. You know, he mm-hmm. flat out had to do it. He doesn't remember until later on in the movie. And the dragon, like, he has this fight scene with the dragon, which is pretty – Galen's pretty brave. I mean, like, to do stuff by himself. Like, even when we see him early on, he goes into that dragon's lair by himself.
Yeah.
He's a pretty brave dude. And he kills the babies and then goes in there. And I love the way they animated the dragon when she sees her babies are dead.
Yeah, she is pissed.
It just turns – the face just turns like mad as hell. And then you see this huge dragon going through the cave on his elbows, you know, like because he's got wings and stuff chasing mm-hmm. him. And it's just awesome. He's just so pissed. And he's pretty brave because he puts his shield down so he could lure the dragon in. And then he gets on top of like this cliff and then jumps off the cave cliff. And pierces the dragon,
mm-hmm.
but it—I don't know. I like even when I was watching it, like I just was amazed how much I love it. Like it meant a lot to me as a kid, and it still means a lot to me to this day.
That's cool. Yeah, I mean, I don't have the nostalgia factor with it, but I was pleasantly surprised by it because I think that it does. You know, it takes a simple plot. I mean, it's a pretty similar plot to The Hobbit, you know, just the basic book. There's a dragon that needs to be killed, and a group goes to try to kill the dragon. You even have, but in that hews more towards your traditional fantasy tropes, you know. And I think right from the beginning, even though there's more to it than that, when you have this wizard that's kind of like Gandalf and then he gets stabbed and he seems to just die, you're like, okay, this is going a different direction, you know? And Galen, like you said, he is very brave, but there's a, like a cockiness about him that he seems youthful and he doesn't look or really act like your typical fantasy hero or protagonist, you know, like Peter McNichol, the actor that plays him, he doesn't look like your typical hero. And so then you have the whole gender switcheroo with Valerian that undermines expectations. You know, what the princess does and the fact that like he has to try several times and to kill the dragon before he's finally successful. You know, it just, that puts across the difficulty of the task. And then to talk about the ending, again, you have this sort of tongue-in-cheek, almost sarcastic worldview being presented, because like once the dragon's actually dead, like you have Ulrich and Valerian, the people that are really responsible, off to the side watching as the king comes out, takes the spear and to the already dead dragon and is posed and hailed as Slayer of Dragon, of the Dragon Slayer. And it's like the fact that that's the name of the movie, it fits in that it's about Galen trying to kill this dragon, but then when they actually say Dragon Slayer in the movie, it's as a part of this title that's a false title because the king didn't even do it, and I think
he's already cooked. I mean, he's right. Fried.
Right. So it almost, I like the way that neatly wraps it up, is like, this is a different take on a fantasy trope, and it's a serious movie, but it's also like a satirical one, kind of poking fun at the fantasy genre.
Well, this was your first time watching it, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So let me ask you this. Did you think the sorcerer was dead when you watched the film?
Yeah.
So it kind of surprised you when the sorcerer came back alive, and it's really the sorcerer that killed the dragon.
True. Yeah.
That's the twist of the thing that I just think is amazing, because, when he realizes about the ashes and stuff, he's like, my master couldn't make the journey, so he had us carry him as ashes. I just think that's awesome. I am amazed how sophisticated that plot line was, and it kept it from us.
I still kind of like how, the king takes responsibility, and it shows you, the king in a lot of stories is a noble character, but this shows the king in this story is embarrassing and kind of a coward, and someone that'll take credit for somebody else's actions. And so, yeah, I mean, just with the different plot twists and the different...
Even the king blames, like, his brother for the dragon stuff. You know what I mean? He's like a coward, because he talks about a noble knight that his brother was.
Right.
And his brother went to go slay the dragon.
Oh, that's right.
And he blames his brother for the attack on the town and the burning of the villages and the death, because his brother failed to kill the dragon. And it was his idea to come up with the lottery. Do you know what I mean? It was, mm-hmm. he took credit for everything.
Yeah. So it is kind of a critique of, like, you know, rulers that are content to just be complacent, like, let's not actually deal with the problem. Let's not actually depose, this situation. Let's go with the status quo, even though we have to, like, they'd rather sacrifice a virgin girl than actually remove the dragon for good,
Yeah.
So, yeah, I thought it was good, actually.
Well, it was cool to see it again. I was glad it was on Amazon Prime too. I know you had to get the disc.
Yeah, I got the disc, but it was pretty good quality, actually.
Yeah.
DVD, but Peter McNichol, I was trying to think of where I know him from, and I realized it was from Ghostbusters 2.
Yeah, that's what me and Barb were trying to. As we were watching it, I was on the elliptical one night, and we're trying to IMDb, because he looks so familiar. His face and his smirk, look like he's been on TV shows or movies, and we were just Googling it to make sure we knew what he was in.
Yeah, and I didn't recognize Caitlin Clark, the actress that plays Valerian, but apparently she was in Crocodile Dundee, which I have seen.
Yeah, I didn't recognize her as that.
I didn't recognize her. But unfortunately, she passed away in 2004 at the age of 52.
Wow.
But
and one of the interesting facts is this was up for an Academy Award special effects. against Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom.
Oh, wow.
And it lost.
Yeah.
But the dragon was, I mean, don't you think the way they did the dragon, it still stands up as like a good special effect? Like, it's really good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I thought for the most part the special effects in the film were pretty good. I didn't think they were going to be. There's an early scene of the dragon being dragon, and I think it's one of the girls that's trapped in its lair.
Yeah.
And there was some like parts of the monster or something that looked a little funny in that one scene, but it was sort of a false alarm because for the rest of the film, I thought the special effects were really good. A lot of the like flying scenes.
Yeah.
Dragons flying around in the air. Those looked really good.
Yeah. And when the dragon's pissed off and it's moving, like the fight scene with the shield and everything.
Yeah.
It's pretty cool. Like they did a good job with the head coming out of the water and like he's looking the other direction, you know, and it just comes up in the back of him.
Yeah. Yeah. And the breathing fire, that was really cool. Yeah, talking about how it's surprising to have nudity in the PG. There was also, it wasn't very violent.
Disney film too.
Yeah, Disney film. I didn't realize that until I looked up it up on IMDb. But yeah, when the baby dragons, when he goes back in and they're feeding on the princess.
Yeah.
That was pretty gross for a PG because they're biting into her leg and like there's some like gooey, fleshy, bloody stuff.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was cool. I'd never even heard of the movie before you talked about it, so it's fun to discover something. What I'm interested, a question I have for you is, I know that you don't typically draw to the fantasy genre, so what do you think's different about this film that you like?
I think you described it perfectly. The hero didn't fall into that trope at all. Like, he just seemed like a kid that was like a Han Solo guy going to kill a dragon in his master's absence. He didn't have any, like, heroic fantasy type. He just seemed like a guy.
Right.
Yeah. And everything seemed more grounded in reality, even though it was a fantasy film.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, lotteries were a thing, you know, like in Hunger Games and stuff. And the only thing that really made it fantasy was the fact that magic was real and there was a dragon.
Right. Yeah, I can see how if you're not into the fantasy genre, the fact that it doesn't completely take itself seriously and it kind of subverts a lot of the fantasy tropes that you're used to, I think I could see how someone could get into it.
Mm-hmm. But I do like fantasy. It's just I don't like role-playing. Like some of the movies I like are like, you could say like Conan is fantasy, right?
Yeah, definitely. That's true.
Sword and the Sorcerer, Crawl, Beastmaster, you know, movies like that I watch.
That's true.
So I even like to watch, I like Lord of the Rings, you know, for the movie. And I watched the cartoon The Hobbit as a kid and I enjoyed it. I tried to read The Hobbit and it was rough. I tried to read it for a book report. And I was like, God, I don't want to ever do this again. I should stick to my John Steinbeck and I'll be happy.
Oh, that's interesting.
John Steinbeck was my go-to guy. For one thing, I enjoyed his stories a lot. And the other thing is the novels were not that big. You could finish a John Steinbeck book relatively quickly. Of Mice and Men, The Pearl, all those different books that he wrote, I could finish really quickly. And I understood the flow of the story, you know?
Yeah. He's got some that are longer.
Yeah.
But the ones you named, yeah, those are... What's there, there's one with the horse... Something... There's a horse in the title. I can't think of it, but yeah, he has got a number that are shorter. Grapes of Wrath is longer.
I read Grapes of Wrath, too. He was my go-to book report, because you had to write book reports. Mm-hmm. And I found that I was so into comic books, Chris, that I hated books. I hated books. I didn't so much mind like textbooks, you know, because you're teaching yourself like physics, or I've always been into the physics or the math. I would be able to absorb, but I never cared for reading history. Times have changed now. I'm a very different person now. But I didn't like history. I didn't like English. There was things I absolutely hated, and my mind gravitated towards mathematics, science, those kind of fields. And I hated book reports. I absolutely despised them. In elementary school, I got to choose. Like, I remember doing the paper boy. What was his name? Henry the paper boy and Ramona. Those books I used to love to read. But other than books, I couldn't stand it. But Steinbeck for me was like, as soon as I read Of Mice and Men, which was the first one I read, I knew I liked his writing. So I just started to go down that path. And every time I was assigned a book report, oh, John Steinbeck, I'll go to him. And then I'll read Batman afterwards.
Right. I mean, he's a good choice. He's definitely a great writer. I was the opposite of you, though. I've always gravitated towards English and history, and I hated math I liked for a while, but then I got to a point where I didn't like it anymore, and I never was really into science, but I also had some pretty bad teachers, which can make a big difference. I can't say much about the science teachers I had. Where some of my math teachers for a while, they were pretty good, but And it helped. I had really good history and English teachers, as it turned out. East of Eden by John Steinbeck is one of my favorite
novels. Yeah, I read that one too.
I love that book. At least I did when I read it. I got into reading at the same time I was reading comics. As a kid, I got into Stephen King books. I started reading a lot of Stephen King books. I think I was only like 10 or 11 when I started reading Stephen King. It's interesting that I was allowed to. I always remember that there's this store called The Paper Cutter that it doesn't even exist anymore. And we were about to take a road trip to Florida, so my mom let me pick out two Stephen King books. And I picked out The Shining and Misery. And those were the first two.
It's the only Stephen King book that I've read from beginning to end.
He's got a lot of books, but yeah, I've read a lot of them. So yeah, I was on a Stephen King kick, and I read a lot of Stephen King growing up, which could explain some things.
I haven't read a lot of books in general. Like I said, I just never – I guess I've always had comic books, and I've navigated to that medium. I don't know if it says I have a lack of imagination or whatever, so I need
– No, them. I would. So.
But I don't know. It's weird. I read what I read, and I stuck with the go-to. Charles Dickens was another one that I would always read.
Oh, okay.
Other than that, man, I didn't read a lot of books. The only time I did was when I had to. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting. Interesting stuff. So that was Dragon Slayer. Have you already picked what we're going to do next?
Yeah, I think I'll go with what I sent you yesterday. I think it was. I think we'll watch The Burbs.
Mm-hmm.
Because I want to figure out if I've seen it before. I think I have, but I don't remember. But I think Kara liked my choice. She said she'll probably watch it with me because I guess that used to be one of her favorite movies, and her and her friend used to watch it over and over again, but she hasn't seen it in a long time.
I think I remember a scene on the lawn, and that's about it. And then I keep getting it confused with the Money Pit. That's the one that I remember. I remember Big in the Money Pit pretty good, but I don't remember The Burbs too well. Or Joe versus the Volcano, for that matter.
Yeah, Big, I know I've seen. Big, I've seen a lot. But yeah, The Burbs, what the hell happened to it? I hate Netflix right now. They used to, you'd log in and your queue would be right there at the top. And I don't know if they freaking...
Now it's like in the middle. It's like three quarters of the way down or something.
It like moves around.
Yeah.
Anyways, but... because I just wanted to say that it is from, there we go, 1989. No, I don't want to watch it.
Joe Dante.
By Joe Dante, and he...
Carrie Fisher's in it, too.
Joe Dante is an interesting director. He's done a lot of, like, he's a big fan of cult movies, and they're definitely a big influence on his own work.
There are Gremlins. That's the one I know him from.
That's, yeah, probably one of his biggest ones. But, yeah, so Tom Hanks, Bruce Dern, Carrie Fisher is in it. And it deals with, obviously, as it takes place, there's in the Burbs, and it's about... There's a theory that that one of the new families that moved into the neighborhood is a front for a cult. So it's kind of like a cult favorite. Mm-hmm. And I've wanted to watch it again, or I think it's again, and confirm that I've seen it before. It's like sometimes you have those movies that you've been aware of for so long.
Yeah,
and you see clips of them, and they're just like kind of get into your subconscious, and you think you've seen them, and then you sit down and watch it, and you're like, you know, I don't think I've ever actually watched this from start to end.
Yeah.
But yeah, Joe Dante is pretty much, he's known for Gremlins, Inner Space. It's a pretty big one.
Inner Space, I remember seeing, but it's like The Burbs to me. I don't remember anything about it.
Yeah, so Joe Dante, he's had kind of an interesting career. He's one of those, like, Roger Corman guys that, like, kind of came out of Roger Corman's studio and stuff. But he's, like, a big proponent of B-movies. And, like, he's, besides making his own movies, he's, you know, done a lot of champion of other people's movies. And
yeah, in the 70s, he did the Piranha. I remember seeing that.
Yeah, the original.
And then the Howling. I remember seeing that, too. So he did his share in the horror genre.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, check that out for next time. It's on, so if anyone wants to watch it, it's just was recently added to Netflix streaming, if you've got that.
Yep. All right. That takes us to comic books. So,
yes, it does.
I have four. And I'm going to try to be quick on them. But the first one I read was because my father-in-law gave me a bundle of mystery comics. It's like a mystery bundle. I guess he ordered through a magazine or something like that. Oh, and it cool. came with Spawn and Batman, which I already had and I'd already read. And I thought I would read it for this episode. I felt like I was in the mood for Spawn. And it was pretty good. I enjoyed it. The artwork was what stood out more than the writing. It amazed me how Todd McFarlane drew Batman to look a lot like Norm Breyfogle's Batman. he does his face and stuff in shadow. I mean, there's a lot of stuff that makes you look like a Norm Breyfogle Batman. It was very much told panel-esque, like a Spawn comic book. So even though Frank Miller wrote it, it still had like the reporters. Like if you ever read Spawn, it would have the reporters talking and it would do it through that viewpoint. But the story is pretty simple. It opens up in Gotham where Batman invades a warehouse and he fights like this metallic creature. And he thinks it's a robot, but once he deconstructs it and destroys it, he finds like these robotic gloves that give him like powers in the warehouse, and he's able to smash up the robot, and he finds a human head in there, and he's like, what the fuck? And he actually pulls it out of the robot, and he realizes it's just a head. And he's like, man, this poor dude's in there in this robot machine, and he's just a head. It turns out he's not only just a head, but he's homeless. And it leads him to New York, where Spawn is. And that's how they end up fighting this humanitarian who's really not a humanitarian, but is looking to destroy the world. Her name is Dr. Margaret Love, and she owns a company called Heal the World, and it makes it look like she's helping society when she's really looking to drop a nuke on New York City. So it was an interesting story, and some of the things that were cool is the fight scene between Batman and Spawn. Is that Spawn at this time was real reluctant to use his powers because, you know, he always had that timer that was counting down how long he had to live if he kept using his powers. So he didn't want to use his powers to fight Batman. And Batman, like, gassed him one time and made him so sick he was, like, throwing up, like, a lot. He got real sick to the stomach. But Batman in this, Frank Miller wrote him like a total jerk. Like, he kept on using the word punk. He kept on calling Spawn punk and, you know, in that deep, raspy voice. And when they were teaming up, even, he didn't seem like he wanted to team up. And but they ended up teaming up and fighting. But it seemed like Spawn was more of the heroic that wanted to learn and stuff like that. And Batman just didn't want to help him. Even at the end, after they defeated Dr. Love from launching a nuke from a naval ship, Batman threw a batarang right into his head. Even though he wasn't Spawn wasn't controversial at that time, so it was an interesting book. And in the back it was dedicated. Jack Kirby actually died in 1994, and he said, Jack Kirby was the greatest artist in history of comics. The effort is dedicated with respect to the finest talent any of us have ever witnessed. So that was cool. So, yeah, it was Spawn, Batman from Image and DC Comics. And there is a Batman Spawn, but this is the one I read is the Image version.
Nice.
It's like a graphic novel. It's like square-bound books.
Like prestige format.
Cover price. It's interesting enough. Prestige format, cover price is $3.95. You pay $3.99 for comics nowadays.
Yeah. It wasn't that long ago, really.
Yeah.
So everything I read this time, I picked up. On Friday, I went to a store that has a whole bunch of 50-cent bins. And I just spent a while. I was off that day. I spent a while just... I don't know, I find it relaxing just to look through comic bins. Every once in a while, just hang out and just go through and see what I might find.
Yeah.
And I've been... intrigued and interested by Archie lately.
Mm-hmm.
And so I decided I didn't see many in there, but I did grab a copy of Life with Archie number 235.
Afterlife or Life?
Life with Archie.
Is that the magazine?
No, it's a comic book size.
Okay.
This is from it when they came back with The Married Life. That was kind of revive. That was a revival sort of Life with Archie. But this was just a regular comic book that ran back before that. This is actually from 1983. It's issue 235. But and like I like the cover is neat. It's Archie standing in a football uniform, standing with Betty and Veronica on either side of him in cheerleader outfits. But then it's bisected like into puzzle pieces, and the puzzle piece that features Archie's face has fallen off from the rest of the puzzle to the bottom of the cover, and he's saying, "Sigh, I can never seem to get it all together." But I just thought it was a clever cover and a nice drawing. So it actually, the issue actually has, I think, three or four stories in it. The first one is by Frank Doyle with art by Stan G and inks by Rudy Lapik. It's called The Rubies of Caramel. Caramel spelled with a K. And it has this character in it called Cricket Odell, and she can sniff, use her nose to ascertain the accuracy of things. So, like, they show her in the beginning with Betty in a candy shop or some kind of store, and they have, like, a guess how many pennies are in the jar thing, and she goes, "Sniff, there's $12.07 in there." Like, well, that's exactly right. It's like, but she refuses to take the prize because, you know, she has the unfair advantage, you know. Or she, like, they come across Archie on the street, and she sniffs and smells that he's got a $5 bill in his book that he's about to return that he forgot that he put in there as a bookmark. So that kind of establishes this ability of hers. And they remember that there's an exhibit of these jewels. So they go, the three of them go to it. And when, so they're put out for examination because it's the first day of the deal. And this expert looks at it with the microscope and stuff. It's like, yes, beyond any doubt, these are the four rubies of caramel. And Scarlet, she smells and says, "Oh yeah, those are the real deal," from the crowd watching. But then, once everything kind of disperses and the guy that delivered the rubies leaves, they go up to the rubies and Cricket smells them and says, "Wait, those aren't the real ones anymore." Like, what the heck's going on? So part two of the story, you know, they talk to the museum director and like, this is ridiculous. Get out of here, causing a disturbance and all that. But then they end up catching up with the guy that delivered the rubies, who's carrying a bag with them. And it turns out that he had this like fake case made. So they had the original real bees on top when they were testing them. And then you push a little pin on the side of the box and it flips over. And the fake ones are cemented to the underside that flips over and drop the real ones in the bag that he took with them. So Archie and Cricket and Betty saved the day. The director of the museum asks Cricket at the end, "I wonder if we could interest you in making a monthly nasal inspection of the museum's priceless treasures." Sounds like sheer delight. So they get a reward, and Cricket gets a new job, apparently going in once a month and smelling everything, sniffing everything in the museum. I guess all the stories are by the same creative team, but there's another story called Avalanche, where Betty, Veronica, Archie, and Jughead are climbing up a they're climbing up a snowy mountain, and as you might guess, there's an avalanche. Betty and Veronica are like on top of the snow, but they're freaking out because it seems to have gone right over Veronica and Jughead. It's like, it's no use. They're gone. Why? Why did we have to climb this stupid mountain? And Archie's like, wait a minute. Do you smell something? But he's like, burgers? Frying hamburgers? So then they look and they see the smoke coming up from the distance. And it's coming out from under this rock. And they lift up the rock and there's a hole there. So they climb down in it. And it's like a natural cavern. And they find Jughead and Veronica. Jughead's cooking some hamburgers over a fire that he made. They couldn't find their way out, but he had like extra hamburgers on him, of course, in his pack. So now that they know they're safe and they can get out, they all just like they stay there in the cave for a little while. They have some hamburgers.
This is a little tangent, but did you happen to read Archie number 2 yet?
I haven't read either of them yet, actually, because, well, number 2 I have coming in my next box, but I added Archie number 1 late, and I don't know if they're going to be able to get it for me because they haven't added it to my next shipment yet. So I actually ordered, I don't want to get number 2 and not be able to read it, so I actually ordered a different cover. Another copy of Archie number 1, but just with like a different cover, that I should have like tomorrow or Tuesday. So then when I get number 2, probably by like Memorial Day weekend, I'll be able to read it.
So I'm really looking forward to those. The reason number 2 is interesting is because it kind of gives you the origin of Jughead, the name and stuff. So.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. It's not what I anticipated. I guess I never knew it. And it's interesting. I'll leave it at that.
Okay, cool. So there's this one last story called To Right a Wrong. And it features Archie and Betty discovering some, actually some, like, police corruption, or at least it looks like it at first. And it's funny because Reggie's in it at Pop's in a scene where they go in and Reggie's reading the newspaper and Reggie's real cynical, you know, and they're trying to figure this officer that they saw earlier, Betty and Archie don't believe that he would ever do anything wrong. And Reggie's real cynical. It's like, open your eyes. Everybody's got his price. But Betty's insisting that they're still honest people. So they go to see the superior officer of the guy that they think is innocent. And they lead him to the guy that supposedly was given the bribe to the police officer, and it turns out that Betty had been carrying a portable tape recorder that got proof on it that the police officer is innocent of taking a bribe. But all throughout, it's really solid. This Stangy is really solid, like on model. Like house style or whatever you want to say, Archie art. And it's cool to see the ads at the time. There's like, they must've been having some kind of like little contest where, you could send in something that you wrote, like the Archie Club News. I don't know what the contest was, but, the first prize they gave $6 to a girl who wrote a poem about a chubby squirrel in her grandma's backyard. And then the runner-up got $4. for writing a little letter about how teachers will spend more time with kids that are struggling in school. You know, like it says, when a class is through with their work, a teacher will say to the smart kids, find something to do or I'll give you something to do. But then they'll tell the not so smart kids, come here, I have a game to teach you, or something like that. They act as though we were invisible. When they do notice us, it's to give us extra work. I say it's time to give all kids equal attention and equal schoolwork. So you got $4 for writing that?
That's a huge paycheck.
Seriously.
And that's why they kickstart stuff.
Yeah, that's, I don't, they gave out too much money to kids in the 80s, and now they need that money back. So yeah. If you could send your $4
back. $4 back, please.
So they can get Betty and Veronica relaunched.
Yeah. That's cool. I've been reading a lot of Archie too, but more contemporary, current stuff. But one thing that I think you're gonna love, just because you love the history like I do, is the current series does a fantastic job of telling a great modern day story, but it also has Golden Age stuff in the back, and I have cool. never read Golden Age Archie, and I find that just as entertaining as the upfront story.
Yeah.
That's it was cool. It was funny because Wade was breaking down like terms. He's like, I understand that most of you reading this Archie book won't know what these terms are because it's, you know, from the Golden Age. And it's funny because I knew like 90% of the terms.
Nice.
So I was like, yeah, I know what those terms are. That makes me really old, I guess. They're the 40s terms, but I knew what they were. And there was a couple of references to names and stuff, and I had no idea who they were. Mm. But he tells you who they are, which is That's interesting because cool. one of the guys is that they reference, and I think it was Pep Comics that they did in issue two, is a guy who broke the record for speed back then, and he had gone 60 miles an hour. I thought that was fascinating.
Nice.
Yeah. I think you're going to really get your bang for your buck once you get that story, because I think you're going to see it from two different angles. You're going to enjoy the current story arc, and then you're going to enjoy the historical thing, because I do. I find it amazing because I kind of grew up on Bronze Age Archie, but I never, never, ever knew Golden Age Archie.
Yeah, me neither.
That's cool stuff.
Me neither. I think I will too.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
So I went back to a couple of old favorites. I continue down Hawkman Volume 3, which is the Blade Hawkman in the 90s. After the last two series with Vandal Savage and Hawkman going nuts, I like loved it. And I said, I want to finish it. There's only three more issues. So I read the next one, which is 31. The writing team changed. It's kind of interesting because it was by Christopher Priest, who's a pretty well-known name now, mostly from his Black Panther run. And the art was by Howard Porter, and Howard Porter is currently doing the artwork for Justice League 3001. And this is his stuff in the 90s. And this story opens up with a murder that's going on, and it happens to be John Jones is actually on the case as a detective trying to figure out who's being murdered. And him and Hawkman are both trying to find the murderer. And at one point, John Jones thinks that Hawkman is the murderer. So that's where the conflict with Martian Manhunter and stuff comes in to play. And it's a really interesting story because it almost felt like it was a reboot, kind of like the soft boot that we experienced after the Convergence. I thought they were going to reboot Hawkman here because it felt different. But as I got halfway through the story, they link it together to the previous arc because John Jones goes to talk to his mom and Shiera and the one woman that was able to who thought she helped him by taking away some of his mental voices he was hearing. But now he's really gone apeshit. He's talking in the terms, every time he refers to himself as we, like there's multiple voices inside of his brain. And he's working with the detective to also solve the murders, the same time John Jones is trying to solve the murders. And it's pretty interesting and violent. But it leads us into where he actually captures one of the guys towards the end. And he has like this falling out or team up at the end with Martian Manhunter. And they're talking about Thanagarian technology and all that stuff. And the weapon that they had. And it looks like it's going to lead into the next issue. A matter of fact, this is a three-part story. So Hawkman and Martian Manhunter are now working towards the same goal to find this murder. So yeah, it was a good story. It was kind of jarring at first, but I enjoyed it. Not as much as the previous arc. The previous writer I really liked, Christopher Priest, was kind of a closer in a lot of series at this time period in the 90s. Is like they'd bring him on to finish titles. I think he did like Justice League Task Force too.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, he did a couple of things like that, and he was told to finish off Hawkman. So we'll see where that goes. I like the way they portrayed Martian Manhunter. That was pretty cool.
Nice.
I hope they resolve the Hawkman insanity thing before the series ends. Because he's just totally gone.
Yeah, that's interesting. I don't know that much about that era, so I don't know if they do or not.
Yeah, I'm interested to find out. I have two more issues to wrap it up, so I hope they get past or at least find out why he's hearing all these voices and stuff and are able to at least tame the beast.
That can be tough sometimes.
Yeah.
Taming the beast. Yeah. I've had trouble getting the beast under control sometimes myself.
Pulled pork.
Yeah, especially when there's a lot of pulled pork around. don't read too much into that, people. So, next on my list is The Brave and the Bold, number 118. It's kind of a beat-up copy I got for 50 cents, but it's intact. And this is Batman and Wildcat co-starring the Joker. May the best man die. By Bob Haney and Jim Aparo. And Jim Gordon and Batman, they got a guy in prison named Mike. I don't know how you would say it. Dubcek. Dubcek. Dubek, something like that. Mike Dubcek, I'll say.
Dubak.
And
Patrol Dubak. I had one of those.
What is it?
Patrol Dubak.
Yeah, what is that?
It's a Star Wars toy.
Oh, is it? Okay.
It's the lizard-looking creature that the stormtroopers rode.
Oh, okay. Episode
one. I had a Patrol Dubak.
I can picture them. I didn't know the name of them.
Yeah. It had this little hatch in the... So you could, like, stand your figure up, but it would look like it was sitting down on the top of it.
Nice.
Yeah, I still have it. Patrol Dubak. It's a nice cover.
Yeah, it is.
And there's a lot of retcons recently, within the last, I don't know, 20 years, where we learned that Wildcat actually was one of the trainers of Batman. So it's kind of interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, so...
And Huntress and everybody else. Black Canary.
Right, yeah, they put him as kind of a mentor.
Yeah, he's like the mentor to teach him street fighting.
Right.
Boxing.
Yeah. So they got this guy, he's a henchman of the Joker, and they got him in solitary confinement until he decides that he's gonna spill the beans on the Joker and what he's up to. But the Joker has a bribe on this guy that's related to the prison. And so then they set up, basically Joker manipulates things to set things up so that this Dubsec has to do a fight with Ted Grant. It's like entertainment for the prison. And the warden says, well, I promised Batman Gordon I'd keep him in solitary, but I'm sure a few hours out won't hurt. So they have the fight, Ted Grant and this guy, they box. And it looks like Ted's down for the count for a moment, but he gets back up and hands up winning. Then 2 days later, it turns out that everybody in that prison is infected with this mystery disease, this rare tropical fever that's never been seen before in the country. And it started with this Dubsec, and then it spread to all the other prisoners. So Batman figures that the Joker's responsible somehow, and it turns out that the water bucket that Dubsec had in his corner was used to infect him, and that's how it was spread to all the other convicts. So that's how kind of Batman and Wildcat get connected. And so there's the scientist at a university nearby that's been researching the disease, and he's got a dog whose body, the dog has enough antibodies in it that they can use the animal, transfer the blood from its blood and use it to inject the prisoners to save them. But when the dog's being transported to the prison, the Joker gets involved and he causes an accident and stuff, and the dog gets loose. Joker actually tries to take the dog, and the dog escapes and goes running away. So there's kind of like this sequence of events where they're looking for the dog, and the dog gets picked up by a dog catcher. And meanwhile, Wildcat and Batman are scouring the city, Gotham City, to try to find this dog. And Batman gets close at one point because he goes into an alleyway where a bum says he hasn't seen the dog, but he's actually hiding the dog under some newspaper because when he first meets the dog, he gets the dog to do some tricks and sees that the dog is well-trained and that he could possibly use him to bring back this act that he used to do with the dog. So anyway, eventually Batman's like, oh man, why didn't I think to go to the dog catcher? Well, when they're on their way there, Joker gets in on his police band frequency and tells him, if you, I've got the dog now. If you want to give it a chance to live, come to Jefferson Square Garden and don't go to the police. So the Joker sets up this fight between Batman and the Wildcat, which is what we see on the cover. And he actually makes them fight wearing these gauntlets that are called cestus. They're from ancient Roman boxing where they wear these metal gloves with spikes on them. And so he's got the dog in the one corner of the ring with a gun to it, and he keeps making them fight harder and harder by threatening the dog's life. And so you don't really, because when this was published, you don't see any blood, but the captioning references that they're bleeding a lot because they're basically punching each other with these spikes over and over again. And Ted's actually starting to do like quite a number on Batman. He says, "You almost tore my head off." And, but they're doing it because they don't want the dog to be killed. Eventually they kind of knock each other out. And Joker reveals that he had put the disease on the gauntlets. So they've affected each other by puncturing each other's skin with the gauntlets. So it's looking pretty bad. The Joker's like, "Oh, I'm going to kill the dog anyway." So his henchmen take the dog out to the docks, and Batman makes a last ditch effort to try to solve the situation where he tells the Joker that, because the Joker's just been bit by the dog on the wrist, that the dog's actually not filled with antibodies, but the germs of the disease that's going around. So Joker freaks out at the idea of dying from the disease, and he gets to the docks just as the dog's being thrown in with the weight around its neck. And so Joker jumps in after the dog, but then realizes he can't swim. So Batman catches up and has to save the dog and the Joker. Actually, no, he doesn't save the Joker. He just saves the dog. And so all's well that ends well. The dog is saved, and he's a hero because his blood is used to save all the criminals. And Batman actually has the dog at the end of the story, him and Wildcat. Batman's holding the dog.
Bat-hound.
Yeah.
What kind of dog is it?
I'm terrible with dog breeds. It's they call him Spot, and he actually looks like that one Spot dog from the ads. He's like a little white dog. He's got a spot around his black spot around his eyes.
You said he looks like the dog from the what?
Wasn't there like a Spot dog from like a
Little Rascals?
Yeah.
Yeah, Petey.
I think he looks like that.
He looks like. He's a pet bull.
I should ask. Kara, are you still up here? Can you look at this dog and see what kind of dog it is?
She's a pet bull. If it's
she's
like
way
Petey.
Better. She's going to look at it in a minute because she's way better at dog breeds than I am. It's like right there. There. It's in a couple panels in the page. Or you can flip through the comic. Anyway, so yeah, it was a good issue. Good Bob Haney issue. Not too zany, but it was an interesting plot that not many would come up with. It might be the way it's drawn, it might even not even really be able to tell what kind of dog it is.
Well, if it's like the Little Rascals, it's a pit.
It's a mutt. I thought it kind of looked like the Little Rascals dog with the spot on its eye.
Pete.
She said it looks kind of like a Jack Russell Terrier, but it has...
Oh, wow. That's a lot smaller.
Yeah, it's kind of small, but it has, like, floppy ears.
They're very hyper dogs. Terriers. Jack Russells. Yeah.
It's a mutt. Some kind of terrier with floppy ears.
Mm-hmm.
That's better than I could have done. I don't know. I gotta learn my dog breeds, so I can be the dog lover I'm supposed to be.
All right. Well, the next one I got is Maze Agency. This is number 4. I think I've covered number 3 on this show before. These are done in one stories. This is from Kimiko, and the year is 1989. This is a good one. The creative team is Mike W. Barr, who's done a lot of Batman, and Adam Hughes on pencils, Rick Magyar on inks, Michael Urey on as the editor. So those are all names that I know. This is like a group that gets together, like of criminologists that get together every year to discuss who Jack the Ripper is. So that it opens up because Gabe, who's one of the detectives that works for Miss Jennifer Mays for the Mays Agency, is invited. He's always been going there this year, and they said, "Why don't you bring Jennifer?" So he brings Jennifer. And then there's like a criminal lawyer, a court sketch artist. There's a retired captain, and then his wife. There's a supermarket owner and his wife, and there's a Dr. Gordon Harker, who's the founder of the group. And they start going over who Jack the Ripper is and who they really think he is, and they start talking about it being Sir William Gull, a personal physician to Queen Victoria. And that one doctor, he goes apeshit over that, and he's like, it's possible. He can't be it. He's a Freemason, because this guy's he really supports the Freemasons. And all the other guys, well, all evidence points to him rather than Prince Albert and all this stuff. And they get into a heated argument over who Jack the Ripper is. And one of the guys leaves, and he gets a slit throat. His throat slit as he's leaving in a Jack the Ripper fashion across his throat. He's the grocery store owner. They rush him to the hospital, and he doesn't die. And essentially what happens is it's a mystery from here on out, trying to figure out who's getting killed. And as each one of these criminologists and people studying Jack the Ripper, they all get their throats slit, and they're all starting to get picked off, and you don't know who it is. And then it falls into the pattern of what Mays Agency is all about. It sets you up it's almost like a TV show. It sets you up for who the bad guy is, and then they resolve the bad guy in the end. And it turns out to be it's one of the wives. It's the wife of the captain that was going to inherit the money once he passed away and wanted to get his retirement. She ended up using this as an excuse to kill off all these people just to get to her husband. And it has the very – the way Mays Agency is structured, it reminds me a lot of Scooby-Doo. Like Scooby-Doo goes the mystery, and then they end up solving the mystery. And he's like, oh, you crazy kids. But yeah. It's a little more sophisticated than that, but it has the Scooby-Doo flow. And it was really cool because Jack the Ripper has always been fascinating, and it's cool the way they led us to believe that the killer was Dr. Gordon Harker all along, and it wasn't. The reason they led it to believe that is the actual killer, who was whose name was Wilma, she actually kidnapped Dr. Gordon Harker so he would look like he's the guilty party. And that was a kind of cool twist. But it was a good story, and Adam's used pencils are awesome as usual. And a good done-in-one mystery that I enjoyed quite a bit.
Nice. Do you say that series is pretty much all done in ones?
So far.
As far as you know.
I bought a good portion of this series a long, long, long time ago when podcasts were new to me. I started listening to Comic Book Noise with Derek Coward.
Yeah.
Derek Coward has a soft spot for Mays Agency. It's one of his favorite titles. So I started listening to this podcast early on, and I'm like, I got to check that out. And I started to buy those. He read a lot of indies, so like Kimiko and First and stuff. So I have a lot of full runs of titles that I never read. And, Mays Agency is one of them. So, I really like it. It's good. It's interesting. It has the done-in-one flavor to it. But it's got like an underlying theme. Man, it reminds me of Moonlighting. The two characters remind me of Cybill Shepherd and Bruce Willis, because didn't they have like a they would lead you to believe that they were going to be a couple and they never were. That's kind of like what these two are.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, that was always Hollywood. Well, I didn't watch a lot of the show, but as I understand it.
Yeah.
Kinda,
I didn't watch a lot of it either, but what I did watch, that's what this felt like.
Right. Yeah. Nice. My last one is the first part of a four-part story. And I was able to get all three, or yeah, the all four parts of the story for 50 cents. It's from Legends of the DC Universe, which is a series that I never really, I've never read any of them. But it was interesting getting this, though. It's issue number 33, because it came out around the time that I was getting into DC, about a decade and a half ago. But the reason I picked up the story, it grabbed my eye, is that it's a four-part Hal Jordan Spectre story, and it has really cool covers, painted covers. At first they almost looked like they could be Alex Ross, but they're of a slightly different style. And the artist, unfortunately, I don't have the cover of the name of him in here, and I looked at Phil Hale. He didn't do a lot of covers. He did these, a few vertical things, but I guess he was working as an illustrator, and now he's more of a fine artist, and he does interesting figure paintings. It's almost like somewhat realistic, but then almost as if it's like smeared, slightly obscured. But yeah, his covers for all four of these issues are really cool. And the storyline is called Destroy of Worlds. The interior art is by Michael Zulli, which I didn't recognize at first, but then I looked him up. I realized, remember I talked about Puma Blues way back when? He's actually the same artist. And the writer is J.M. DeMatteis. And I find that J.M. DeMatteis is really good when it comes to like mystical characters. And
yeah, he does a lot of like Doctor Strange and Doctor Fate and all kinds of shit like that. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's an interesting issue because most of it is not, it only briefly introduces what seems like it's going to be the protagonist, but most of the issue is with Hal Jordan kind of processing being the Spectre. At the beginning of the story, he shows up at what he thinks is heaven, but it's kept ambiguous. It seems like it might be a version of heaven for him. And this being that is also kept ambiguous keeps appearing as different people in his life. At first, he thinks he's being greeted by his mom when he goes into heaven, and they talk to each other, and you know, she says, I was excited to see you again. I had found out that you had died, but then you were sent to purgatory, and I was heartbroken. But I hear you're back on Earth. And he tells her, you know, yeah, I'm the Spectre. It was the only way. And she says, you know, well, that seems like an odd way to atone. Ripping out people's entrails, turning into a giant cheese grater and shredding them. Which I like that because, you know, it references kind of the way that the Spectre was back in the day, where he'd turn into different things. And it was always very, like, related to what they were being punished for. And so they talk a little bit about where they are and how it's his heaven, but not necessarily the heaven, before she turns into Jim Corrigan, the former host of the Spectre. And Hal tells him, you know, I've been the Spectre for a few weeks and it's been a real nightmare. I thought it was a lot to have the power of the lantern and compared to that, it's like I don't feel like I'm controlling the specter. The specter is controlling me. And it's just like I have to watch when he punishes the guilty. Talks about some of the things that have happened, some of the punishments that have happened, and how difficult it was to watch. And he's why he asked Corrigan why are some people not punished and other people are, and Corrigan basically tells him, look, it's like you're working for God, you have to proceed on faith. But then it turns into Barry Allen, and Barry says kind of something similar but in a different Barry Allen style. He says, you know, lighten up. Maybe what Corrigan said was right. Maybe God knows more than you do. And he takes off. And Hal talks about just seeing Barry makes him feel better. And then he also, Ollie Queen was dead at the time as well. So he sees Ollie. He's like, maybe you're dreaming me. Maybe I'm dreaming you. Doesn't it matter? Does it matter in the end? And he follows him through a replica of Coast City. And Ollie's like, you know, how do you know I'm not projecting your unconscious? Or maybe I'm your guardian angel. Maybe I am God. But it doesn't really matter. You didn't really come here to figure out who I am. You came here to figure out who you are. So then Hal's back on Earth, and it references JLA number 35 and his recent encounter with the Justice League. And he knows that even if he appears to people that he knew in his life, they won't recognize him. They won't see him as him. So he's tempted and goes in and sees Carol Ferris and sits down and talks to her for a moment, until her date comes back. And he just says that he used to work for Carol's father at Ferris Aircraft, and leaves. So the only sign, really, there's a page where Hal walks out of the restaurant and he dissipates into the ether. And this guy that's like bald, he's got a goatee, he's wearing sunglasses, he's got a strange belt on. He says, gone, but you've left your trace behind, and a trace is all I need. Each part of the hologram contains the entire picture. This one imprint left hanging on the ether will tell me all I need to know about you. And then he's floating in sort of a astral projection, kind of. And you see the astral projection go back into the body of a guy that this woman is sitting across the table from talking to. It says, call. C-A-U-L, call, honey, you listening to me? So then that's kind of teased there. The rest of the issue goes into more of Hal struggling with the new existence, talking to Green Arrow some more. And he recounts a interesting scenario where he went to, as a specter, there was a guy. You know, it just reminds me of some of the things in the news recently, where a guy went to a nearby fast food restaurant and killed 7 people and wounded 12 others, and then went back home and shot his family. It's like, obviously, there's just a lot of like monologue going on as this is happening. Like, and he's telling the story about contemplating, like, this person definitely seemed to deserve the wrath, and then but when he saw the specter, it seemed like he was happy to see me, that he wanted to be punished. But instead, this scenario happens where, like, everybody in the restaurant has the face of the guy that killed them, and the specter comes in with guns and shoots all of the people that look like the killer. So it's very like contemplative issue. One of the last things that happens is Hal goes and sees his brother and his niece on a park bench, and he goes and sits down next to him, and they see him as like this blonde guy with like a crew cut, and so he talks to his brother a little bit and to his niece, and he actually says that his name's Hale. His brother says, "Your name's Hale?" "Yeah." And he says, "That was my brother's name." "Was?" "Yeah, was." And Hale leaves, but as he's walking away, he says, "Family's important. Cherish it. Cherish her. She is beautiful, Jack, and she's got Jan's eyes." And it's like, how did that man know mom's name? And then the final thing is a bit with Abin Sur, which again is like the being that keeps appearing to him as different people. But then when, and that's all happened as he's in like this heaven area as Specter, but then when he's back on Earth and the Hal Jordan guys, Abin Sur walks up to him, says, and Hal's like, how can you be here? I thought you were a divine projection. He's like, I'm not much of a philosopher, but take my word for it. I am Abin Sur, the spirit of Abin Sur, and I'm going to be here for some time. After all, you could use a friend, and that's how it ends. So the next issue seems to go more into this call guy call and what he's after and what he's going to do to the Spectre. But yeah, if you enjoy DC history and everything, like, it's a very interesting issue to read. Just it's very kind of slow paced, but interesting and contemplative, and the way that Hal is kind of dealing with his new existence and stuff at that time.
Yeah. The spirit of redemption instead of vengeance.
Yeah. He's trying to wrestle with his new existence and have some control over the Spectre. And okay, back on the very last page, it does say that Phil Hale did the cover. So,
yeah, I had covered a few of those issues on this show, number 1 through 5 or something like that.
Oh, right, that's right, yeah.
Yeah, the Superman arc and Wonder Woman arc. I have the full run of that, but I haven't read it all.
Mm-hmm. So do you remember reading this story? Because I think you'd really dig it.
No, I don't think I read it at all. I didn't read any of them except for 1 through 5. I bought the full run of it late. I didn't buy it when it was coming off the shelf.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was cool seeing some of the ads in here, though, because of that time period. I remember seeing some of the stuff on the shelf, and this is when they were doing, they had that tagline, "The Original Universe."
Yeah.
Like, there's an ad for, I actually would like to read, there's an ad for an Elseworlds that I never heard of until I saw this. That's like the Secret Society of Superheroes. It's a 2-issue prestige format by Howard Chaykin.
I don't think I've heard of that one either.
Yeah, that looks interesting. It's got an ad for Batman Ego by Darwin Cook. I'm aware of that. I've never read it. And then it has an ad for that Heaven's Ladder, the oversized graphic novel by Mark Waid, Brian Hitch. That I do remember. I actually remember buying.
Yeah, I think I read that.
Yeah. But, that's my last one.
Yeah, I haven't read a lot of the, like I said, historically I skipped a lot of the Elseworlds. Because right. I said, that's not real.
Yeah. I want my continuity.
Yeah. I was more of a continuity buff than I am now.
Right.
Back then I was like, is that Elseworlds? I don't need to read it because it's not in continuity. But to me, everything is in a historical sense. So yeah. Now. So right. I also continued my pattern on, this is probably my longest running book that I cover on this show, is John Sable Freelance by Mike Grell, number 8. So this is from First Comics, and we just got over his origin story and such. And last issue, we got introduced to his buddy that's in films. That's an aging, like, Zorro type action figure, stuntman. And all I could say is John Sable has a lot of money because he's in his house, his apartment, and he has this awesome shower. Like, it's got like four shower heads, and it's like in, he's got like plants and shit in his shower and cobblestone rock and everything. And he's taking his shower and the phone rings and he goes and gets it. And it's his buddy. And this is what's interesting is it's that stunt man from LA. And he knows that he's also an author as well as a freelance mercenary. And he's like, I'm going to have to tell everybody that you're a children's author and a bloodthirsty adventure for hire if you don't let me help you. I need some purpose in life. I want to be your Holmes to his Watson and Quixote to Sancho Panza. And he's like, what the hell's going on? I have to let this guy in my life now? And he's sitting there in his towel naked and some girl got into his house. I don't know how this happened, if he can afford an alarm system or anything. And she actually pulls the a gun on him. It's actually his gun, Sable's gun, because it looks like a Luger. If you ever see John Sable, he's got like a Luger. And she pulls it on him and says she's what was her name? Her name is Trina Cole, and she doesn't really give a purpose. But he immediately attacks her and slaps her, knocks her down. And he gets his gun back, and she tells him that she just broke in to try to get his help because her boss, Andrew Sherman, who she worked for, took her off the streets and gave her a job, and she really loves this guy for helping her out. She's an African-American lady, and she came into the office her boss's office one day and saw the safe open, and she tried to close the safe or to see what was there, and the security chief walked in, Vance Hawkins, and kind of framed her as the thief, and she pushed this guy and knocked him unconscious and then went to go see John Sable. And so everybody in the corporation thinks that she stole money out of the safe, whereas she didn't steal money out of the safe. And then Sable's editor calls, and she's like, from the last issue with that bomb hit and everything, she's like, what the fuck did you do to my car? It was not insured and blah, blah, blah. She starts yelling at him. And he essentially says, Eden, you know, look out your window. She looks out her window and there's a brand new convertible outside her car, outside her window. She says, I don't know what to say. And she says, why don't I fix you dinner? And then you can come over and I can show you my appreciation. Like, she's going to get it on with them. And she's his editor. And he pretty says, I'd love to do that. Keep everything warm for me, but I got a mission I need to go on. So he goes to help this lady. And, just like Mays Agency, they introduce you to all the players in this corporation, and you try to figure out who's behind stealing money from the safe and framing Trina. And it turns out to be one of the girls that's working at one of the bars that I guess she's a lounge singer, that one of the security guys started to become infatuated with, and he busts her. And then as he busts her, that's when the whole story takes a weird twist, a really strange twist, because he finds all the money that was taken from the safe, and inside of that safe was a top secret document, and he pulls that top secret document out, and it says Operation First Strike. And as soon as he starts looking at it, a bunch of other mercenaries run in there with guns pointed at him. And that's how it ends. It says next issue, cliffhanger. So, yeah, I love this series. I think it's one of Mike Grell's best. And it always is. And they actually made a TV show out of it. I never saw it. It was only like a couple episodes, but I know that Gene Simmons of Kiss was heavily involved or
Oh,
trying to be
really?
involved in it. But it
I
was
didn't
a,
know that.
yeah, it's a real interesting concept, and he's an interesting character, a very tragic character who's got a really cool identity, because who would have ever thought like a children's author would be a mercenary?
Yeah.
And it's just an interesting cast. Now he's got like an Alfred guy that's working with him, because he'll be blackmailed if he doesn't allow him into his life. And then there's that love interest with his editor. Maybe he's gonna get laid next time. I don't know. But it's a fun comic to read, and the only reason I keep coming back to it is because I want to keep reading it until I finish it.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah, it's really good.
Yeah, I like hearing about it. I had read the first few issues at one point and never got back to it, but I like hearing about it. And yeah, it's a good series.
Yeah, I kind of want to get, man, I don't want to change topics because, I mean, my goals, but I do want to visit more Kimiko and First Titles, you know. I'd like to
Yeah.
complete those dead universes too. Even though they weren't like shared universes, they were like really good independent comics
Yeah.
that I'd like to finish at some point. But I'm going to go to a con now and look for some Brave and the Bold. Who knows, I might get that Wildcat one.
There you go. Probably one that's in better condition. Do you?
I shoot for VG or higher.
Yeah.
I'll only go VG if I can't find anything better, but or if there's like if the difference is like a $25 book to a $10 book, then I'll go VG. But I like fine or higher. So we'll see. I finally completed my Supergirl. So
All right, yeah.
yeah, I ordered we were doing the Valiant podcast the other night, and I finally ordered the 1972 issue one for a price that I thought was affordable, considering that damn TV show is making it go up so high. It just makes no sense. It's not even her first appearance.
Yeah.
None of this hot book stuff makes any sense to me. I don't know who causes it, but it works. Whoever starts this speculation stuff, it manages to sell books at a high price. I can't figure it out. Like, I was shocked to see Suicide Squad New 52 going for hundreds of dollars. I'm like, what the fuck?
Yeah. And people are buying it at that price.
Yeah, between 50 and $100, they're buying it. Makes no sense. Because that
Yeah.
book I know won't retain its value.
No. Yeah, I hope no one hangs on to it too long.
Yeah, I told Keith he should sell it. He doesn't care about it. Especially if it's New 52, he doesn't give a shit.
Right, yeah.
We
Yeah, I
should
mean,
get
he's
rid
already
of it
sold a
right now.
lot of them.
All he has to do is put it like 99 cents and put a shipping price on it and see how high it goes. I bet you
Right.
he'll at least make 30 to 50, because you don't
Sounds like
see
it.
it anything at that price right now. They're all high. They're all CGC'd. But yeah, we are done. And thanks for all the questions. We got a lot of questions.
Yeah, good ones.
Yeah. So,
That does it. Put it in the books.
put it in the books, and we'll see the burbs. You can join us for the burbs next in 2 weeks. And
Yes.
if you have Netflix, you can check it out there. And
Indeed.
we are located at geekbrunchpodcast.com. We have a Facebook page, Geek Brunch Podcast. You can post in, it has Geek Brunch proper and retro on there. And we also like iTunes reviews. You can leave an iTunes reviews on the iTunes page. Search for Geek Brunch Podcast and leave a review there. If it's for retro, make sure you put put out that it's for retro.
Make sure you, yes, if it's for retro, make sure you put out.
Put out, yeah, that you put out and you pull your pork. The other thing is Twitters. You could hit us up on the Twitters at @MythMakingETC and at Mike Myers Brunch. And MythMakingETC at gmail.com and Mike at ComicBookNoise.com. And I think our friend Brian is going to start up his comics and history soon. So
yeah,
sounds like he's got a lot of interesting DC things coming up. Mm-hmm. That's why I like it so much, because he focuses so much on DC.
Yeah.
What I'm interested in. I think that's it. Did I say everything? Oh, you want to plug your From Kid to Flash?
Sure. MythMakingEtc.com. Check out my solo shows there. Kid to Flash is main focus, main series. Looking at all Wally West's appearances. So
do you have a lot of those in the can still?
No, I'm kind of caught up, like, and working and releasing on the current one.
Yeah.
But I have one mostly done for tomorrow. It's actually a Titans Without Wally, I'm calling it, where I'm looking at some issues with Teen Titans that they didn't have Wally in, particularly. There were four backup stories that went in a row that told about Lilith.
Lilith.
Mm-hmm. So, and it talks about how she was trying to find out who her parents were.
Adam's first wife, and he couldn't put up with her in the Bible.
Yeah, talk a little bit. I did some research. I mean, where that like story came from, and I talk a little bit about like the Lilith mythological figure and different Liliths and comics and stuff before I go into the stories.
Yeah,
nice. It was interesting. Yeah.
All right. Well, you have a good one. I'll let you know what comic books I buy, and we'll talk to you later.
All right. Sounds good.
All right. Bye.
Bye. Bye.
I've come to help you with your problems so we can be free.